Good morning, everyone. The penultimate edition of Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're also on Sportsnet TV as well. We're having a good day. Show Adley, Nick Ashbourne with you these next couple of days. Nick, how are we doing this morning?
Good. It's an honor to be closing it down. Last time we did this, we had difficulty getting this beautiful studio to work for us. We're going to have it these next couple of days. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw. So we were filling in for Blake for a couple of days, and Blake is done for the year on Jays Talk Plus, but he's ramping up for the Raptors show, which will begin in a couple of weeks. He has the Raptors media day on Monday, then the Raptors play in Montreal. So a lot of Raptors stuff going on for Blake. So he's busy, but he did say that we were responsible for breaking the studio, hence everyone being upstairs. So I'm glad it's working. I'm glad there's no one in here after us. So if anything goes wrong, you know, there's some time to fix it before Blair gets in later.
Yeah, but I think the problem is he's already sort of established the idea. He's floated the idea that we're responsible for the technology. So if things do in turn go wrong, there's already some breadcrumbs with that. And it could put us in a tough spot, to be honest.
I blame Ailish and Justin, frankly. That's what I do.
Always a fair call.
Let's start with last night, though. Jays beating the Red Sox 6-1. And I am certain, Nick, that some Jays fans took pleasure in this, but the Jays helping to knock the Red Sox out of the playoff chase. Tigers and Royals both winning in style, both winning their 84th games of the season yesterday. So with the Jays win, Red Sox can only win 83 games. So, you know, you can do the math on that one. And look, to be fair, the Red Sox, it was pretty unlikely, I would say, for Boston anyways. Like, their playoff destiny was not entirely in their own hands. You know, they kind of needed to win out and then also needed one or two of the remaining teams, Tigers and Royals, most likely, because they currently occupy those spots, kind of lose a little bit towards the end. So, you know, like, again, not entirely up to them, but in a season like this, I'm sure it's not that hard for Jays fans to find some solace in putting the boots to a division rival.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think they came into the game with maybe below 1% playoff odds. Yeah. It was that bad. Like, it was a Mortal Kombat situation. They were kind of dazed and kind of staggering around, and the Blue Jays finished them, and that's what it was. But you know what? In a Blue Jays season where, from a competitive standpoint, it's been kind of disappointment after disappointment, this is a little feather in their cap.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's is it going to make headlines? Probably not. When I fixed up Jays Talk with Blair and Barker last night, did I have them lead with that? I absolutely did. So there you go. That's the kind of season we're talking about here. Let's talk about Kevin Gausman a little bit, though. Gausman finished his season last night. He spoke to the media for the final time. We'll hear a little bit from Gausman in a sec. But 6 innings pitched, 4 hits, 1 run, which was earned. 3 strikeouts, 3 walks, 93 pitches, 59 strikes. He did run into a little bit of trouble in that 6th inning of work, his final inning. So there were runners on 2nd and 3rd. I think it was a double, then a walk. Nobody out. Casas with the RBI single. O'Neill grounds into a double play, which, frankly, I by the way, that double play, I thought was some great work by, I guess it was Clement to Jimenez to Barger. And Barger and Jimenez combining to get the runner to going to 3rd. I believe it was Willier Abreu. So I thought that was great work on the double play to help out Gausman. Yoshida gets aboard after an error. They review the play. He is safe at first. So now it's still 2 on. Story walks. The bases are loaded with 2 outs. And then Nick Sogard pops up. And then the inning is over. So he gets out of it. Like, he gets out of a fairly busy inning traffic-wise in that 6th inning. But all things considered, a quality start from Gausman in what ends up being his final season of the year. The velo ticked up on the four-seamer to 97.9 miles an hour. And that's where it, like, topped out. It kind of sat average-wise at around 94.5 miles an hour. I was pretty impressed, all things considered, by Gausman, considering his season was a bit topsy-turvy to start this year.
It's clear that his season has not lived up to expectations, and kind of from the beginning, right? There's issues in spring training from a health standpoint. He got started a little bit slower. He stumbled out of the gate a bit, but his last 10 starts, you're looking at a 2.64 ERA, and that's the kind of number you sort of expect from an ace-level pitcher, which is what he was in 2022. It's what he was in 2023. The thing with him that I think you're always going to end up coming back to when you look at his 2024 season is sort of, where did the swing and miss go? Where did the strikeouts go? Because over the prior 2 years, he was truly one of the best strikeout pitchers in baseball. He had a 29.7% strikeout rate. That was 3rd best among qualified starters. This year, it's 21.8, which is 36th.
Right.
Huge difference. So, you know, you described that whole scenario where all these guys are getting on and you got walks, you got errors. The way he got out of it was with this heads-up double play and then a nice pop out at the end. realistically, in prior years, the way he got out of those type of situations is just striking guys out. And he's always given up relatively hard contact. Like, what's made him special is he strikes out a ton of guys. He doesn't walk many guys. And that sounds overly simplistic, but that's kind of the reality with him. Because when guys put the bat on the ball against him, generally speaking, they have hit the odd home run. They have made good contact against him. That's not what he specializes in. He's not a contact suppression type of dude. So he really generally has had to run these great strikeout rates to be that guy that he's been most of his Blue Jays career. So when he comes back in 2025, what you really want to know early on is especially the splitter, it's often the splitter with him, is the splitter really forcing guys to swing and miss at an elite level? And is his strikeout rate going to bounce back? Maybe not all the way to those amazing years, but maybe meeting somewhere in the middle, because he sort of needs that to be a top of the rotation starter long-term, sustainability over a full season. He needs to be a really good strikeout guy.
So Kevin Gausman is 33. He'll be 34 at the very beginning of January. So next year, like, for all intents and purposes, is his age 34 season. And, you know, I think there is it's a valid question to ask for really any athlete. I don't think this is only a pitcher thing, but it, you know, for pitchers, I think you talk about this a little bit more because of velo and, you know, being able to actually throw the ball as hard as you used to. Because velo early on in Gausman's career, even in his very first year as a Blue Jay, wasn't really an issue, right? And this year we've just talked about it a little bit more, which is why I was actually kind of surprised to see that thing get up to high 97, 98 mile an hour and on the four-seam fastball. It just never really been something we've worried about before. And again, I mean, I think for the most part, after his weird start to the season, after the first, like, say, 4 to 5 starts of the regular season were in effect his spring training starts, it wasn't a lot an issue often of the time, but I do wonder if that is something we should be looking out for going into 2025 in his age 34 season. I've had this conversation with Chris LaRue, a former major league pitcher himself, and Chris talking about, you know, as you get a little older, you do have to, I think, make a somewhat of a differentiation between thrower and pitcher to a certain extent. And I don't know if Gausman's like 100% there yet, but I just wonder if that's going to continually be something you and I talk about down the stretch of his contract. He's under contract until the end of 2026.
And that's literally something he said after last night's game. He said, I'm getting older, so I need to make adjustments. And he understands that. You're right. Velocity had not been a problem for him in all of his Blue Jays career. And so this year, it wasn't every start. It wasn't like every start, you're like, oh, man, right, it's 92. But there were a couple starts where it was like that, where he's sitting more 92, 93. It's clearly harder for him to make his stuff work in that way. And it's interesting to contemplate, like, is he the type of guy who might age differently than other pitchers because his style of pitching is more simplistic? He's not necessarily outthinking opponents. He's beating them because his stuff is so good, because the high fastball works, because the splitter works against it. It's people generally know what Gausman is going to do, more or less. Like, he mixes in the slider a little bit. Sometimes he throws a fastball a little bit lower when people are expecting a splitter. There are a couple things that he can do. But generally speaking, he's more of a simple guy from an approach standpoint than, say, a Berríos, than, say, a Bassett. Like, think of why Chris Bassett has aged so well into his mid-30s. It's because he's got this crazy variety of pitches to throw at you. That's not Gausman's game. So these adjustments he's going to make are going to be interesting, because I'm not sure there's that much he can really do with a relatively simplified repertoire that he brings.
So we're talking about Kevin Gausman here, and you mentioned his, you know, his awareness, let's say, of what needs to get better for next year. And I mentioned earlier that, of course, his spring training was not a regular one. He only got one start in during the spring, which was, I want to say, the last day of spring training. Might have been the very last game that the Blue Jays played down in Florida. Let's hear a little bit about Kevin Gausman. This is the pitcher talking about what needs to change going into the spring for next year to maintain where he's been at so far.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about it. Throwing my sinker more, you know, throwing it in the offseason, I think it's going to be a pitch that will allow me to go deeper into games, get, you know, first pitch outs against righties. And so definitely that. Everything else I'll kind of take a look at and, you know, see what I need to do. Mechanically, I think I found where I need to be. And so, you know, that's good to know kind of going into the offseason that, you know, just kind of keep right there, you know, made the adjustment to kind of simplify my mechanics, and it's definitely led to me being more consistent.
there's Kevin Gausman talking about some changes that maybe he's aware of, needs to be consistently mindful of as he goes into the offseason, which I find interesting because, I mean, he talked about, he specifically highlighted the sinker, which will be really interesting. So he threw 93 pitches last night. What, would you care to guess how many sinkers he threw?
Oh, well into the single digits. Yeah. I'm going to say below five.
He threw two sinkers last night. He threw nine sliders. Every other pitch he threw was either a fastball or a splitter. And I mean, look, that's pretty typical, right? You're right on the nose. Like that's pretty regular for a 2024 Kevin Gausman start. I will be interested to see how he uses the sinker, especially vis-a-vis, you know, the sinker being somewhat of another form of a fastball. So to be interested to see how the velo conversation we just had plays into the usage of the sinker. But he talked about the mechanics too. And Nick, you and I have done Jace Talk Classic, let's call it, and a number of times during Gausman starts this year. And it's kind of funny because he has been very vocal. And he was, again, just now, you saw and heard that conversation with the media from last night. He's been very vocal about tinkering with those mechanics, finding that, I think one word he's used before is like the magic mix, finding the right split with certainly how much to use a splitter, how much to use the fastball, but how he's hunched over on the mound, you know, what the release point is, where his elbow is, all these different, the minutia of things that make pitchers good to great. And clearly he's found something that really works for him because he and Pete Walker have been tinkering with this basically all year. But it's good to know that he feels he has found that. And it'll be interesting to see if he can kind of hold on to it between now and the spring, I'd say.
In an ideal world, that's the type of stuff you figure out in spring training, right? Like that's what spring training is for a veteran pitcher. And maybe him really adding in the sinker will make it a more of an offseason that a younger pitcher would have trying to develop the repertoire. But generally speaking, if you're a veteran pitcher, you're showing up, you're building yourself up from a workload standpoint, and you're making sure your mechanics are sharp. And he wasn't able to do that. And it kind of took him a lot of the season to figure that out. And what we discussed before in terms of the velocity being inconsistent from a start-to-start basis, often that is because of mechanics. The mechanics are off slightly, and that can cost you like a mile on your fastball, a mile and a half on the fastball. And again, with him sitting more in the 94 range than the 95 range, that makes a difference. And so you lose that, you're down to 92, 93. Suddenly you don't really have an above average fastball anymore and you're really relying on that splitter. So it is interesting for him to say that, okay, going into next season, I'm where I need to be. And so maybe that means that in spring training, he can really work on that sinker. Again, you pointed out, he really hasn't used it much this season. I think it's about 5% of his pitches. So there's reason to be skeptical of that. We just haven't seen it yet. Yeah. And it'll be something we follow next year going into the season. Is that actually going to be a weapon for him that makes a difference in 2025?
Yeah, heading into his age 34 season, Gausman has in his career thrown over 1,700 innings at the major league level, which is frankly incredible. That's a lot. He's a workhorse, right? Like that's a lot of innings for a lot of pitchers to throw. And honestly, I do wonder as we go further like into the new world of major league baseball, bullpens are deployed pretty liberally, as we know. I kind of wonder, like, you're probably going to see fewer pitchers who do the kinds of things that the guys like Gausman and Berríos and Bassett do, who are maybe like the last versions of guys who would do the things that Scherzer and Verlander and even obviously like the historical greats from well before them used to do as well. I only bring it up because you also got to think that, you know, as he talks about redeploying a pitch of his in the offseason, in the spring, and hopefully into next season, you know, you got to think he knows his body pretty well. Like if you've been around in Major League Baseball to get to 34 years of age and to throw well over 1,700 professional innings, then you probably know every minute feeling of your body better than literally anyone. And you know what you're capable of and what you're not capable of. So, you know, hence the, not last night, but the previous start when he went out with the back tightness, and he said after that game that he was feeling something from the time he was throwing his warm-up pitches, and he still managed to go pretty deep into that game. So it clearly he's very familiar with how his body works. It'll be interesting to see how that plays into preparation as he gets just a teensy bit older going into next season.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who are over 30 are familiar with the concept of back tightness, to be honest. And when you talk about these workhorse pitchers, again, like Gausman, like Bassett, like Berríos, it's not necessarily that these guys are invulnerable and they simply cannot be injured. Part of it is that they're able to fight through discomfort. We see this with Bassett a lot. Like you watch a Chris Bassett start, there's a good chance you're going to see some kind of grimace going on. Like these guys have done a really good job of, I don't think they push it too far necessarily, but they identify, if I can possibly go, I'm going to go. And again, because I know my body well, because I'm a veteran, I know where to draw that line, and I know how to fight through discomfort. And that's got something Gosman's able to do. Yeah. Bass is fantastic at that. Berríos does seem a little bit more Teflon. Like, I know he's just a really athletic guy. He's a little bit younger than the other one, so you don't see that as much with him. But that is part of being that workhorse. It's not just not getting injured or not getting hurt. It's being able to navigate around that discomfort.
Yeah, Berríos, a guy, you know, you don't want to, like, knock on wood, but, I mean, he has been very durable his entire career, like, well before he was a Blue Jay. Like, since he's been drafted by the Twins, he's been very, very durable. So that's been a hallmark of the Blue Jays' rotation. And as they all get a little bit older, you certainly hope that sticks. Let's talk a little bit about some of the position players, though. We spent a lot of time talking about Gosman, and I got to talk about some of the guys that made some headlines last night on the field as well. And I wanted to start with Kirk. Alejandro Kirk, 3 hits, an RBI single, 2 RBI single, and then another hit towards the end of the game. Actually, the first one was a double, I believe. But I'm not sure Kirk is necessarily going to be, you know, the cleanup hitter next season, for example. It obviously depends on what
happens. Sure hope not.
Yeah, I think if that's, it's going to be a tough sell. It's a tough sell if Kirk is batting 4.
It'll have an effect on attendance. If people know that on game one he's the cleanup man, people are not going to want to come see that team.
I'll say this, though. I have been very impressed with his offensive performance. Let's say since Danny Jansen was traded, right? So Danny Jansen was traded, if you recall, mid-game on July 27th. So just before the deadline. He was traded a couple days before the deadline. So let's throw out the 27th. So from the July 28th through last night, here are Kirk's numbers. So 44 hits, including 10 doubles, a triple from a couple of days ago, 3 home runs. He has 29 RBI, 15 walks. He's a batting average of .280, a slugging percentage of .414, and an OPS of .757. I mean, those are pretty good numbers for most players, I would say, much less a catcher, but certainly great stuff. You add in his defense, I've been very, very impressed by what you've gotten from Kirk. Now, is this version post-Danny Jansen trade, if this version of Kirk is what you're getting for most of next year, I think you'll be all right with that. But are you guaranteed to get this version of Kirk for a good chunk of next year? I'm genuinely unsure. And I think that's why it kind of makes it hard to 100% evaluate what you're getting from him. Because at no point, it feels like we're closer now, Nick, than we ever have been before to seeing the all-star catcher first half of 2022 version of Kirk. We're not there, obviously, but it's just we're closer than we ever have been. And, you know, it's, are we sure this is the guy you're going to get in 2025?
The missing ingredient in terms of that all-star season you refer to is power. He really hasn't had the power. And I know we're seeing some doubles here. I mean, that's an amazing footage of him just really charging for that double, something a lot of guys would walk in on. And he had his triple. But realistically, he hasn't hit a home run in quite some time here. But even without that, if he has a little bit of gap power, we know that he doesn't strike out much. We know that he draws his walks. He's capable of being that kind of league average, slightly above league average hitter. And for a catcher, that's a really strong position to be. And then for a catcher who is providing elite defense, that's an even stronger position. Like, he truly does look like an above average starter right now. I don't know if he's sort of one of the superstar planks. You say, this is the guy we're building around. This is the core. Here's one of our very, very best players. Maybe not necessarily, but he looks like an above average starter, which is something the team absolutely needs. He's going to bring that at a relatively low salary in arbitration. And one thing that people always wondered with him is about the durability and the workload, right? Like, he's never logged that massive amount of games behind home plate. And part of that has been them trying to give him some rest. But part of that's just been because Danny Jansen's good and they wanted to give Danny Jansen time as well. Like, it hasn't necessarily been that they don't think Kirk can do it. It's just that it's been justified for Jansen to be there as well. And so part of what's encouraging here in terms of what we've seen recently is that they have turned over that starting spot to him. He is the guy who is, he's acting like a traditional starting catcher right now in terms of the workload, and he's not showing any signs of wearing down whatsoever. Anything, he's finishing the season strong. If you look at since August 31st, so like a little bit further than the split you just gave, he's hitting .310. He's got a WRC plus of .127. He's got 7 doubles and a triple during that time. Again, he doesn't have the home run. You'd like to see him put it over the wall a little bit, but the fact that he is having this traditional starter workload and it is not having any adverse impact on the offense is really encouraging when you think about him being kind of the locked-in starter for 2025.
It does make me wonder what the split for games will be, and I guess it does depend on who the other catcher is, because, I mean, Servin got DFA'd. Seems unlikely it will be Tyler Heineman, so it kind of feels like You're either going to go internal with a completely unproven option at the major league level. I'm just going to throw out Peyton Henry's name and good to see Peyton Henry coming back after the scary incident where he got hit by the bat. So he's doing better, which is definitely good to see. But like, if it's not him, then it has to be, or anyone else internally, then it kind of has to be by default a free agent, right? And the free agent market, and obviously it seems like almost a too easy to say, okay, well, the Blue Jays are just going to reunite with Danny Jansen. And honestly, would I hate that? Probably not, but depends on how much money Jano is going to get in free agency, whether it's the Red Sox paying him, the Blue Jays paying him, or some other team paying him. But let's put aside Jano for a second. Like, the next biggest options for a backup catcher on the market, like James McCann is out there. Yasmani Grandal is out there. Elias Diaz is out there. Kyle Higashioka is out there, but I mean, Kyle Higashioka's actually played reasonably well with the Padres, so for a team that made the playoffs, so maybe he wants to either stay in San Diego, or maybe he's even priced himself out of the Blue Jays range, depending on how much money they want to allocate to the backup catcher. And the other part of this, too, for money, is how much money Kirk is going to make, right? Because Kirk is going to go into another year of arbitration. I believe he has settled with the Jays to avoid arbitration, as most players usually do, and if he's getting a teensy bit of a raise next year, I'll probably make what? $3.5 to $4 million.
Yeah, he could probably get into the four range.
Yeah,
I think.
Let's call it four. Okay, so let's call it four. So if you're playing around with all this money, how much money should you reasonably be allocating to a backup catcher? I suppose you could pay a backup catcher like as much as you're paying Kirk, but you're not going to pay like another catcher more, I would imagine, than just to be the 1B guy and catch like 60 games or whatever it ends up being, or even less, or even maybe slightly more, I should say, depending on what the split ends up being. So I just find that whole conversation really interesting, because Kirk's been great, and I don't mind giving him a little bit more behind the dish, but I'm not sure it's going to be a slam dunk. This is what you're getting from him in 2025.
I just find the conversation around him interesting because it feels like there's an assumption that he needs that kind of 1B tandem guy. And that's just because that's what he's always had.
Right.
And again, I think that's more because Jansen has been a really effective player, not as much in 2024, to be honest, but in 2022, 2023, he was something they really needed to have in the lineup relatively consistently. Like, he was one of their best power threats on the entire team. And people forget that a little bit. So I think that Kirk can handle being, again, the traditional catcher. What does that mean in terms of starts? Maybe right. 105, 110, maybe that's might be pushing it to the limit. I don't think he's going 130, but guys don't generally really do that right. anymore anyway. Yeah. If I'm the Blue Jays, I'm thinking about getting, yeah, one of those type of guys you listed, a guy on the wrong side of 30 by a decent amount that you trust to catch and throw and not embarrass himself at the plate and not cost you a lot of money. And then you take your money and, you know, you got a whole bullpen to build. You got a lineup that needs probably at least two pretty good bats there. So that's not the position I'm worried about. Is it a position where the Blue Jays are going to totally differentiate themselves from the league and have one of the very best catcher situations in baseball? I don't think so. But they'll have an above average situation at a really modest price, and that's a good place to be.
Before we hit the break, we'll chat with MLB.com's Mike Petriello on the other side. Chat a little bit of Jays with him, certainly, but take a look around the playoff races that are beginning to solidify around Major League Baseball. I did want to talk with you, Nick, about Jonathan Clase belting his first career home run. It was kind of funny. It was a two-run bomb. He was like, he booked it out of the box. Like, he absolutely took off. He was shot from a cannon. And he didn't hit like a wall scraper. He hit an absolute bomb. Like, that thing went almost over the bullpen. So it was kind of funny. I think he looked like he slowed down as he realized that it went out of the ballpark, and the ball bounces kind of over the Red Sox bullpen into the crowd. Looks like a fan in the first row of the bleachers caught that ball. Apparently he did get the ball back from the fan after the game, so that's pretty great to hear. I have no idea if Class A is going to be with the team to start next year, honestly, mainly because too much, I think, depends on the moves the team makes in the offseason to really be super clear about what's happening with a Schneider, a Loperfido, a Class A, all guys that at different times, a Lucas even, that have occupied that fourth outfielder role. But, I mean, man, he gets on base four times last night, the home run included in the three hits, a walk as well. Very impressive stuff from a guy the Blue Jays picked up for, like, what ended up being, like, I don't know, like seven games worth of Jimmy Garcia for the Mariners.
Yeah, I think people forget that he was sort of the jewel of their trade haul for a while there, until that Kikuchi trade really surprised and they were able to get Jake Bloss, who was a really highly regarded starting prospect. Class A was the guy who kind of ranked above most of these dudes that the Blue Jays have been bringing in. So, you know, the Will Wagners and the Addison Bargers and the Jimenezes, they've been top of mind because they've been at the major league level. But Class A is someone who doesn't turn 23 until next May. I'd be surprised if he starts with the team next year, but he couldn't have done more to have a good impression here. And his big issue in the minor leagues has been strikeouts. At AAA this year, he struck out 25.8% of the time. You think that'd probably climb at the big league level where the pitchers are even better. So he needs to hit for some power to compensate for that. He needs to make the balls in play he does hit count if there are going to be fewer of them. So it's a really encouraging sign. I think a lot of Blue Jays fans see him. He's leading off. He's a switch hitter. He can play center field. He can run really fast. Like, he looks like that stereotypical guy that you want there. We're not there yet with him. It's going to take some time. He still hasn't played that much at the AAA level. He's still young. There's a lot to learn. But he's an exciting kind of bundle of tools. And to be honest, he has a higher ceiling than a lot of the other prospects they've brought in. He's got a low floor, too. It could totally not work out with him, but he's got exciting tools, and often that's what you want in a prospect, because there's always that chance they put it all together, and bang, you've got a really good player. Like Teoscar Hernandez, great example out of the Blue Jays. They brought him in from Houston. He was just a bundle of tools. Guy could run fast, he could hit the ball really hard, but there was a lot of raw aspects to his game, and over time, he made himself into a really, really good MLB player. Obviously, you'd be thrilled if Class A did anything like that. I don't think that's in the cards, but it's a similar type of idea where you just bring in a guy who has a lot of tools and you see if with coaching and with experience you can bring it together and make him a good MLB player. He's only 22. There's plenty of time for that to happen.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to and watching Jays Talk Plus here on Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Just a reminder that Sportsnet 590 The Fan is proud to support the Canadian Cancer Society CIBC Run for the Cure. That is on Sunday, October 6th. At Sir Winston Churchill Park. So that's at 301 St. Clair Avenue West here in Toronto. That is where registration gets underway at 8:30 a.m. This is Canada's largest single-day volunteer-led event in support of all people impacted by breast cancer. Funds raised will support world-leading breast cancer research and the compassionate support system for all who need it. For full details, you can visit sportsnet.ca/590 or cancer.ca. On the other side, we will chat with Mike Petriello from MLB.com. Like I said, we'll take a tour around Major League Baseball. And I did want to ask Mike, Nick, about a little bit about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. The topic that is at the top of everyone's mind as the season winds down, will Vladimir Guerrero Jr. play first base? Will he play third base next year? We'll chat about that and certainly take a look around Major League Baseball with Mike on the other side. Again, you're watching Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet, listening to it on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the program. Jays Talk Plus here on the Sportsnet Radio Network and on Sportsnet. Sho Ali, Nick Ashbourne here with you. We're in for Blake for the rest of the season, although Nick, the rest of the season effectively means there are three more, let's say, segments of Jays Talk Plus. This segment and two more tomorrow, and then that's it.
Yeah, you made that sound a lot more impressive than it was, but we'll take it. We're closing it down here, which is how I like to phrase it. And yeah, we're going to have a good time over the next couple of days.
We're going to have a good time with our next guest, certainly as well, Mike Petriello from MLB.com joining us here on the program. Mike, how are you?
Hey, guys. Happy, what is today, Thursday? I think it's Thursday.
Time is a flat circle, Mike. It all blends together. Yes. So I don't blame you for not knowing. I often do that myself. Look, we appreciate you carving out some time for us. Thank you so much. Before we take a look around Major League Baseball, chat some of the playoff races going on that continue to solidify down the stretch here, I did want to start here in Toronto. Obviously, you do great work, not only for MLB.com, but for Blue Jays Central. We get to see you often with Jamie and Joe and the crew. I wanted to ask you about a popular topic in this city these days, which is the subject of one Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And I won't ask you to necessarily forecast what his contract will be. But, you know, he said to Sportsnet Shai Davidi a couple of days ago that he considers third base, and I'm using air quotes here, his position. And we'll see what the team does in free agency, obviously. But I am curious, like, who are you moving Vladdy to third for? You know what I mean? Like, in theory, you're moving him to third for like a Pete Alonso or a Christian Walker. Like, I'm not sure it'd be an easy sell to the fan base if you're moving Vladdy to third for like Spencer Horwitz. And I mean no disrespect when I say that.
Yeah, can you get like 1985 Don Mattingly in here? Because I think that would be someone I'd move him for. I mean, listen, I'm a numbers guy at heart, obviously, right? But obviously, you got to remember that these are people. And if he says, hey, I really want to play third, you can't dismiss what makes a player happy or unhappy. Certainly, like we get into this a lot with Ronald Acuna Jr. leading off, which is probably not where you'd want him, but that's where he feels comfortable. So that's where they play him. I think he's, Vladdy is capable at third occasionally. I certainly would not pencil him in for 162 games there, right? Like the numbers don't like him there, but the numbers don't like him much at first base either. So it does seem like there's going to be a point in the not terribly distant future where he's either a full-time DH, or you could probably get away with a couple of days at DH, a couple of days at first base, once a week at third base, if that helps your flexibility. The issue is there's just not a lot of third baseman help. If you don't get Alex Bregman, look around. Who's it going to be? You know, you're probably not going to play some of the younger guys they have there full time next year. Obviously, Matt Chapman's not coming back. I doubt they get Bregman. So for me, it's a little bit less about who's coming to play first base. It's who's coming to play third base. And at that point, is actually Guerrero the best choice there?
Yeah, and too, I mean, you talk about the long-term future. I think the other part of it, too, is Vladdy is so young that if the idea is if you're extending him for, let's say, 10 to 12 years, then, and he's 25, he's going to be 26 for much of next season. I got to think that, you know, by the time he is, let's say, 31, 32, he probably, maybe even before that, he might be the team's, go back to first base, he might be the team's DH. And I mean, you talked about other examples. I mean, we had this conversation before about, let's say, Rafael Devers, right? Like Devers in Boston. I mean, he might not be Boston's first baseman going forward, if only because Tristan Casas seems to be that guy. But I mean, generally speaking, if Devers, who's in a 10-year deal, if Devers by year four or five is Boston's DH, I don't think anyone's going to be that surprised.
No, and there's an obvious comparable here, right? From the not terribly distant past, and you think of Miguel Cabrera
sure.
with the Tigers. You know, he came up obviously like a similarly talented all-time great-ish hitter from the right side, played some outfield, third base, got moved to first base, and then they went and signed Prince Fielder, and they said, hey, Miguel, will you play some third base for us? And he said, yeah. And it went okay. I don't think it went great at third base, but it was fine-ish, and then he went back to first base, and I think your point about his age is well taken. Like, I absolutely do not want to see Guerrero playing third base for the next 5 years, right? Could you do it for half a season at a time for the next couple of years just to make everything else work with a lot of moving parts? Sure, probably. It's not like you're losing an elite glove at first base, and I know he's got the gold glove, which I don't buy into that very much, but you could probably make it work. It's complicated. It's not really the primary course of action that you'd like to be taking.
Mike, you brought up the Tigers there, and I think that's a team that's obviously fascinating for fans around MLB right now. And for Blue Jays fans a little bit in particular, there's a lot of dormant Tigers fans in Ontario. There's a lot of Blue Jays fans who are not happy right now. I think there's an opportunity for the Tigers here to steal some fans, especially in Western Ontario. Maybe you could give us a little bit of an explanation for people who haven't been as locked in on them as like what has happened with the Tigers that's allowed them to make this run, and how dangerous could they be in the playoffs?
Well, you're going to hear me say something about this team that I generally would not defer to, and that is that the vibes are good, because I don't totally buy into everything that's happening here. AJ Hinch looks like he's an excellent manager. We've known that for a long time. It sure helps to have the almost certain unanimous AL Cy Young Award winner in Tarik Skubal, right? And the defense has played a lot better. I know Tigers fans want to say, hey, we started playing well pretty much the day that Javier Baez got hurt, but that's a little mean and a little unfair, and it's not that. What's happened here is that they're going to end up with like a top five September in the history of the Tigers, and they've been playing for like 900 years. And when that happens, pretty much everything has to go right. And you've seen guys in the outfield robbing home runs, and you've seen timely hitting, even if overall the offense is just okay. But mostly you've seen them kind of go all in, aside from Skubal, on the bullpenning and the openers, and they've prevented runs at a pace pretty much better than anybody else for the last 6 weeks. And it's not the plan, right? It's not how you draw these things up. And it's really hard to do this over the course of a full season, but they've done a really good job of finding depth. I know like Tyler Holtland is not a name most people know. Bo Brisky is not a name most people know. These are talented arms, and they have put a lot of work in the last 3 or 4 years since they changed over the front office into improving their pitching pipeline. You know, I think you're seeing the Royals start to do this as well. And so they have guy after guy who can come out in short spurts and show something interesting. And it sure helps to call up the top pitching prospect in baseball and Jackson Jobe in the last week of the season. Wouldn't we all like to have such problems? So do I buy this as like the real Tigers over the course of 6 months? I do not. Can they keep it going for the next 3 or 4 weeks? Sure. That's all that matters, right?
And hey, kudos to you for picking Tarek Skubal, Mike, and your preseason predictions. I know we often don't all get that much right for our preseason predictions, so I feel like it's important to highlight the wins. You got to get the wins, right?
I appreciate that very much, and please do not look at any of my other predictions earlier in the year.
Yeah, hey, I thought the Jays would make the playoffs, so I mean, what do I know, right? Hey, we're talking with Mike Petriello from MLB.com. I did want to ask you about some of the other playoff teams, certainly in the American League, at least before we hit the NL, and the Cleveland Guardians feel like a team we don't talk about maybe enough, because given that they are a team that's going to win well over 90 games, they might be the best team in the AL, even when you include a teams like the Astros and Yankees. But I am curious, like you're certainly going to see them, if they can continue to succeed, Mike, you're going to see them succeed on the strength of their bullpen, which has been absolutely nasty, one of the better bullpens, if not the best bullpen in Major League Baseball. But I am curious, who is their game two starter? I honestly am not 100% sure. It just feels like for a team that is so good, this still has a couple of questions that I'd like answered.
Who are you considering their game one starter?
That's a good question. Kind of,
it's a Bybee, I guess.
I guess.
Right? I mean, the answer is it doesn't matter, I think. And I know a lot of traditionalist fans will hate to hear that, but it's the postseason and there are fewer games and days off. And they've got such a deep bullpen that anybody they throw out for that game two start is going to give them, I don't know, 3 1/3. Right. And then you're going to hand it over to an endless stream of relievers. And we can talk all we want about, is this good for baseball? Is it bad for baseball? Is it entertaining? Don't you miss the days of Jack Morris and Bob Gibson and whatever? That is not their strength. They do not have a good rotation. They have a below average rotation. They are here because the bullpen has been obscene and because Jose Ramirez is a Hall of Famer in his prime. And they've had a couple, you know, Josh Naylor has been very good. Some other guys, Stephen Kwan, but they're here because the bullpen's been great. And I can imagine a scenario where they would do anything to detract from that strength, like ride it, use it. You have all these amazing relievers out of the bullpen. We're going to see them a lot. So I almost don't care who starts. There's going to be pitchers on pitchers on pitchers.
Mike, zooming out a little bit, you wrote something that I think might be the piece of work I've cited the most in my own from a writing perspective the last couple of years. And it was a couple of years ago. So I want to know how your thoughts on it has evolved. You wrote a piece called "Homers Are Still the Key to Winning in the Playoffs." This was in 2020. And what I really liked about this piece is there's this cliche that it's about pitching and defense, and it's about getting that clutch single and moving the runner over. I think the 2015 Kansas City Royals did a lot to make people believe that in the playoffs. And you wrote this piece that kind of debunked a lot of that and said, you know what, it's actually really about who can get the ball over the wall in the playoffs. That's the team that often wins. And so I'm wondering, A, have your thoughts on that evolved at all? And B, if that is still how you feel, which teams might benefit from that into this season's playoffs?
Yeah, first of all, thank you. I appreciate you referencing that and using that piece. I like to challenge, you know, popular opinions with data whenever possible. I don't think my thoughts have changed, other than I wouldn't say it's just about the teams that hit the home runs. Obviously, you need to prevent runs. Getting runs on the board in any way is a good thing. Mostly, I think people like to think that only small ball works in the playoffs and pitching and defense, and that's just not true. Like, we've had plenty of teams slug their way to winning in October. And I think the reason for that, that people don't think about enough is, you know, you get frustrated when you have a guy hit like .180 in a postseason series. And it's like, yeah, well, small sample, sure. But don't forget, it's so much harder to hit. Like, this happens every year. You have just the best pitching staffs and they're not using their number five starter and they're being deployed a little more aggressively. So yeah, it's really hard to hit. And if you've got a tool that can get you a run on the board with one swing, that's a really good thing to have. So I wouldn't rank World Series contenders just based on, you know, home run rate. But I think that's part of my issue with a team like the Guardians, aside from starting pitching, is they don't have a ton of power, right? Josh Naylor can put one out. Ramirez can put one out, sure. But you're going to have a really difficult time against elite postseason pitching if you're just trying to string singles on singles on singles. I'm not saying it can't work at all, but I do think you go back to those Royals teams, that they were a team like that, sure. They also sort of invented the modern postseason bullpen when you think about Holland and Herrera and Davis. And in one of those 2 years, I can't remember which one, 14 or 15, they were a top 10 slugging percentage team. Like, we like to pretend they had no power at all. Hosmer and Moustakas and those guys and Sal Perez, they could put the ball out of the park when they needed to. And it's really not just about one thing or the other. You can't only win with home runs, but you certainly can't win without home runs.
We're chatting with Mike Petriello from MLB.com here on Jays Talk Plus. Show and Nick here with you until the top of the hour. So Mike, if we continue on the macro look back at the playoff field, no 100-win teams for the first time in quite some time. And it does feel like almost hand-in-hand with that, there are no clear favorites. And I know in the MLB postseason, because of the nature of the sport, there are far fewer games, home runs, and great starts from even one guy can drastically affect a single series, wild card series, the DS, the CS, the World Series. But at the same time, I do wonder if you look at any of these teams and have an eye on maybe a dark horse, for example. Because I would love to say that, I'm sure Major League Baseball would love to say that it'll be Dodgers-Yankees in the World Series. But who knows? For all we know, it might be a less heralded matchup. I'm curious if you have your eyes on any teams that we haven't yet discussed.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of picking chalk, I guess. But I really like the Phillies. I've always liked the Phillies. You start out with, where is their weakness, right? Like, you've got two or three aces at the top of the rotation. You've got a kind of stacked bullpen. You have a Hall of Fame hitter in Harper. And, you know, Schwarber won't be a Hall of Famer, but obviously he's been elite in a lot of ways. You have Trey Turner. You've got a manager who's already, like, led them to a World Series. If you're asking me, like, right now, which is the team that I think has the fewest weaknesses, I think it's them, right? I don't trust the Orioles in any way right now. I like the Astros, but I've got some questions about them, especially with Yordan Alvarez's injury. One of the three of us might start a playoff game for the Dodgers. That's where they are right now. So if you're asking me who I'm looking at and saying, hey, I like this team a lot, I don't know how I could say anybody but the Phillies right now.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about sort of the flip side of that equation, because I think a lot of fans, especially fans of, you know, say a team like the Blue Jays, it's a bit of a regional sport, to be honest. People lock in on their team and they're kind of aware, and then they check in on the playoffs. Okay, what's going on? And the way they often do that is by looking at the standings. Like, okay, who's at the top of the divisions? What are the matchups? Who do you see right now whose record, for someone who's doing that, whose record you feel might be the most deceptive, whether it's too low or too high, but someone who's looking at the standings right now and being like, oh, okay, I feel like that team's going to go far, and you're actually more worried about them, or someone who you look at them like, ah, that's just an underdog dark horse. They could be dismissed, but maybe you feel a bit more bullish on them.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, the team who's going to have a nice record, who I'm pretty down on, is, you know, who I just mentioned, was the Orioles, which shouldn't be a shock. They haven't played well in like 3 months, and all of the indicators are pointing in the wrong direction. Like, even their stars aren't playing that well. It doesn't mean they can't get hot for a couple weeks. There's a lot of talent there, right? But I think what's going to happen is, let's say they lose in the wild card round, and whoever they will play will most likely have fewer wins than they will. And people will be like, oh, another upset in the wild card round. And we're all going to be like, yeah, but I don't care about their regular season record right now. Like, they were great in April. Cool. But this team hasn't been playing well for a while. Like, we did this last year with the Phillies and the Braves, and everybody considered that an upset. And I remember being like, well, the Phillies had a bad April and then played at 100 win pace for like 4 months. That wasn't an upset. These are two very evenly matched teams. So I don't worry about regular season record that much. And as far as the other end, a team who probably doesn't have as many wins as you'd think, who looks really good, I'm going to say the San Diego Padres, who just have everything kind of cooking right now. I know the Tigers are probably a popular choice for that, but top to bottom, I like the Padres roster a lot more than I like the Tigers roster, because the bullpen is better, the rotation is clearly better, and there's a lot of stars in that lineup. So I think it'd be very interesting to see, after how hyped the Padres have been and have failed to live up to the last couple of years, for this to be the version of the team that actually makes some noise there.
Mike Petriello from MLB.com is on the program with us. Mike, appreciate this, man. Thanks for carving out some time for us before the postseason begins. It's always a lot of fun. The sheer chaos of it is what I love. I cannot wait for it to get started. Thank you so much, and enjoy.
Thanks a lot, guys. Enjoy the games.
There he goes, Mike Petriello from MLB.com. You know, one thing I wanted to ask Mike about, but I'm going to ask you instead, Nick, all right? So I hope you have an expert
answer
for me.
I'll do my best Mike impression.
You know, I was going to ask Mike about the Yankees specifically, and I am curious. I saw this stat last night. I actually realized that Judge had gotten to 140 RBI in the season, which is, he is the first MLB player to have 140 RBI in a season since the 2009 Yankees, which is, of course, the year they last won the World Series. So I'm sure Yankees fans in the Bronx are quite happy. But I am curious, like, how, as we look ahead to the playoffs, you know, you look at Shohei Ohtani and the conundrum of how to pitch to the Dodgers, knowing that Freeman and Smith and Betts and all, and even Teoscar Hernandez, frankly, are all looming in and around Shohei. It's kind of tough to pitch to any of those guys on the best of days. I am wondering how you pitch to someone like Soto, knowing that 140 RBI lurk behind him. And I mean, frankly, Austin Wells and Giancarlo Stanton have carried the mail a little bit as well recently. So it's an interesting conundrum as we approach the playoffs.
Honestly, this duo of Soto Judge, I think it's the best two-hitter duo you could possibly have created, right? You've got the lefty who gets on base all the time, And then you've got the righty who has the most power in the entire league. Like, you couldn't have drawn it up any better than that. And something with Juan Soto, too, that's important this year is that he's made it harder for people to justify trying to sort of pound the zone against him and mitigate his ability to draw walks because the power has ticked up, right? This is his first 40 home run season. And so, like, I have no idea how you pitch to Juan Soto because he just spits on the balls and he drills the strikes. And I know that Judge is the better hitter just because his power is so ridiculous. But there are some holes in Judge you can find. And what's happening right now is, yeah, you know, Soto is doing his thing. He's on base, you know, over 40% of the time. And then you've got a guy behind him who is, you know, by far and away the best hitter in the game right now. And, you know, that doesn't mean the whole lineup is going to put up huge numbers every single night. Like the guys you referenced behind him, Stanton, Wells, you know, other contenders might have slightly better guys in those sort of four or five spots. But, man, it just at the beginning of the game, your first inning playing against the Yankees as a starter, just such a nightmare.
Yeah, I honestly, because if you manage to get through Soto and there's no one on base, you're walking Judge. Like, I'm intentionally walking Judge. That's where we're at. Like, I can kind of understand taking your chances with Judge in the regular season. I kind of get it because, like, you know, at the end of the day, the result might, quote unquote, only, again, wins and losses are important, but might only be an event that dings your win probability in a one of 162 regular season games. An event that dings your win probability in like one of potentially three games in a wild card series or five games in a DS or CS seven games. I don't know if you can take that chance, honestly. I know people hate intentional walks, but I think you got to be pretty judicious at how you use them when it comes to judging the playoffs.
It's going to be fascinating because it's something that guys didn't do very much during the regular season. He's got 20 intentional walks all year long. Like, that is a very small number for a guy who, again, is producing at kind of near Barry Bonds levels when it comes to how he does compared to league average, because offense is down a little bit this year, which just makes the what he's done even more ridiculously impressive. And you may see more of intentionally walking Judge because you don't want to get beat on, you know, the solo home run in the first inning or whatever it is. And that the fact that he hits in that spot, in that third spot a lot of time, does put him in a position where it might feel more justified than if you put him in the second spot, for instance, and then you would have to have him on base with, you know, less than two outs. That's a different situation. The fact that he's sitting in that slot in the lineup does open the door to that, at least obviously in that first inning, more than it might otherwise.
Before we go, we have a couple minutes left here, Nick, and I wanted to chat a little bit about Vladdy to go. And Vladimir Guerrero Jr., two hits last night, has him on the cusp of 200 hits. He has 197 now in the season. He is now in sole possession of seventh place all-time for most hits in a single season in franchise history. One more hit would tie him with, I believe it's George Bell's 1986 season. And yeah, he has 197. Delgado is in eighth place with 196. Bell has 198. Only five Blue Jays in the history of the franchise in a single season have tallied 200 or more hits. So Vernon Wells did it in 2003, had 215. Tony Fernandez had 213 in 1986. Molitor in 93 had 211. Shannon Stewart in 01 had 202. And John Olerud in 1993 had exactly 200. What do you think? Three games left for Vladdy. It's day off today, but three games left for Vladdy against the Marlins. He needs three more hits to get to 200. Will he do it?
Yeah. I mean, he's got 197 hits in 156 games. So, you know, the logic says he'll do it. The Marlins are not world beaters from a pitching perspective. He's got a chance to do it. I think he will. I think also he'll probably like to have this milestone. So I could see him kind of pulling back on the swing, going for a couple singles, especially if the games don't matter. Maybe in that final game, just be like, you know what? I'm just going to try and hit singles and not hit home runs as much. It'd be a really good accomplishment. It's tough to get to that in modern baseball. There's more strikeouts. The pitching is tougher. There's a reason that maybe only three guys are going to do it this year around the entire major leagues. That's something he's done really well this year. Like, his overall numbers are kind of comparable to 2021 on when you compare in terms of league average and how far he is from that. You could argue even better.
Sure.
But he only has 30 home runs compared to 48. So it's like, how did he get there? He got there because he just gets hits, and it's been doubles, a lot of doubles. He's got nine more doubles than he's had in any season already this year. That's important. But it's also just spraying singles around the park. And so it's been a weird season for him. He only has 30 home runs, 102 RBIs. Those are great, but not world-beating numbers. What's made him special has been the hits he's been getting.
We'll see if he can get three more. No Jays game tonight, but Jays and Vladdy return tomorrow at the Rogers Center for the final series. Marlins come to town. Ben Shulman, Chris LaRue have the call on the radio. You can also watch it on TV beginning Friday as well. Thanks to Mike Petriello for joining us. Thanks to Jen Rolnick, Andrew Adams, Amit Mann. For Nick Ashbourne, I'm Sho Ali. The final edition of Jays Talk Plus goes tomorrow morning. We'll talk to you then.